Good evening. Kind of small crowd, but that's not a big surprise, I guess. This evening, I hope to give you a bit of my faith story and how situations and events come together to present kingdom opportunities. I expect to share some high points and then have a short time at the end for Rob to do a little interview section. My parents were high school sweethearts in the little town of Cherokee in the Hill Country. This is their wedding picture. They were from different Christian faith heritages with somewhat conflicting views. When they became serious about a relationship with each other, they decided to study the Bible together and try to find the truth as best they could, especially in the areas where they had conflict. If they were going to try to live a life together, they wanted to be on the same page on something as important as God and how they were going to relate with Him as a family. A little aside on truth. In the last several decades, there's been a lot of discussion about truth being kind of relative. You can have your truth, I have my truth, everybody has their own truth, and I just don't think that's the way it works. Christ identifying Himself as the truth in the many passages about the constancy of God, as well as my experiences, convince me that God and truth are constant and reliable. That being said, no one except God really has a corner on the market on truth. Our backgrounds definitely impact the way we see things and our understanding, but truth remains what it is. Some truth God has made extremely plain to us, and some He has, at least for now, left us a little bit in the dark on. I really look forward to a day when I can sit at Jesus' feet and He can tell me the full backstory of people like Melchizedek and a lot of others that we just know a little bit about. There's lots of intriguing questions there, but God only chose us to give us a little bit of that for now. Nonetheless, there's truth there. There's a real story there. We just don't know it yet. Truth is what it is, no matter what our perceptions or views of it are, and what answers God chooses to share with us at this time. Anyway, it was important for my parents to find the truth, any of the truth that they could about God and how they relate to Him before they started their family. This focus on the truths of God continued to be reflected in the way I was raised. In later years, looking back on our childhoods with friends and colleagues, co-workers, it seemed that I was one of the very small group of people raised in that era that didn't have a dysfunctional family. That was the big buzzword for quite a while. And my family had our difficulties. We even had some heated discussions from time to time. But there was never a time that I didn't know that my parents loved each other. They loved the Lord, and they loved me and my brothers. My family moved quite a bit when I was growing up because of my father's job, but most of my elementary school years were spent in Corpus Christi, and most of my high school years were spent in Pleasanton, a little town just on the other side of San Antonio from here. This will become somewhat relevant a little later in the story here. As other shepherds have already said, our wives are critical to our role as shepherds. I would not be able to do hardly any of what I do if it weren't for knowing that Linda was by my side and being there for me. Our stories began to weave together at a very early age. She lived in a nicer part of Corpus Christi than I did, but her childhood was a lot less idyllic than mine. Her parents came from kind of complex, difficult backgrounds, and apparently had very little love to give. She grew up believing that her parents actually did not love her. In Bible classes in the church where her father took her, and they would tell her, you know, that God loves you like a father. While these teachers meant very well, that didn't really give her a very good picture of God in the early years. She was a rough kid in those early years, and she had an older sister. She and her older sister ran with a pretty tough crowd. She never actually had to go to jail for anything, but she began to get a lot better picture of God indirectly through a local prison ministry. She was about 12 years old at this time. She began to go to devotionals and church services anytime she could with her newfound Christian friends. This brought her to the church where my family attended. She was still required to attend the Lutheran church with her father on most Sunday mornings. She was also required to attend catechism class. Soon, she was confronting the pastor about inconsistencies between what she found in her Bible and what was being taught in the catechism classes, and how to reconcile, and asking questions about how to reconcile those two, and the pastor couldn't give her any meaningful answers. It's another long and kind of amazing story there, but long story short, she quickly was kicked out of catechism class and didn't have to keep going there. Truth, once again, was the central theme here. It was about this time that I first met Linda. She was the kind of odd girl that seemed to randomly show up at devos and other church events, but was rarely seen there on Sunday mornings. I now know the apparent randomness was because she had to rely on rides and getting permission from her father to go to our church. We continued like this as casual church acquaintances for a couple of years until my family moved from Corpus Christi up to Pleasanton. We didn't see each other, or I suppose consider one another again, until the summer between our junior and senior years in high school. At that time, she and I were picked as a part of a select group of Texas science students to attend a week-long science symposium at UT Austin. I was representing my entire county, and Linda and two other students were chosen from the city of Corpus Christi. Linda was one somewhat familiar face in a crowd of strangers, so I quickly connected with the Corpus Christi contingent. Linda and I became astoundingly close friends almost instantly, with no indications of romance during that week. We just became really great friends. It wasn't until the correspondence that followed that symposium and a few subsequent visits to Corpus Christi that the romance began to blossom. The rest, as they say, is history. A second little aside on truth, kind of with regard to science. Science and technology have long been an important part of life for Linda and I. In fact, Linda currently is making a living primarily as a scientist. Many contend that science and a biblical view of our world are in direct contradiction. Again, I disagree vigorously. I'm quick to point out that the Bible was not written with the intent that it should serve as a science text. I believe that it was written through inspiration to share who God is and how we can reconnect with Him in the loving, eternal relationship that He's always intended. Nonetheless, the scientific truths shared in the Bible are astounding. One quick example. While it can be challenging to slog through some of the law sections of Leviticus, many of these laws reflect underlying scientific principles that would not be understood by human scientists for thousands of years. Some of them have just been reaffirmed or confirmed in the last few years. Again, our backgrounds have a great impact on our perceptions and our understanding. Still, I'll almost guarantee you that if the Bible and science appear to be in clear conflict, you're either reading something into the Bible that isn't there, or the scientific evidence or interpretation that you're looking at have got some flaws in them. As I see it, the scientific method is just a system for gaining a deeper understanding of how God put the physical world together. Anyway, we married after our freshman year at UT Austin. Money was tight, and I wasn't a particularly great student. I alternated working with going to school as Linda continued more steadily toward her nursing degree. I gradually found myself working more and going to school less. In 1986, I landed a job with the Austin Fire Department. It was disappointing to see my plans to finish an engineering degree fade, but it was good to have a steady income and a better opportunity to start a family. Working as a firefighter and a rescue guy was challenging and satisfying work. The unusual schedule, working 24 hours on and 48 off, allowed for more family time than conventional jobs. In particular, it allowed me to be a bigger part of homeschooling our kids, and we had some great family field trips. Eventually, this schedule also helped open up opportunities we never really imagined. Taking just a few shifts off or arranging a few shift trades could provide an impressive block of free time. In the summer of 1994, we went on our first medical mission trip as a family, spending 2 weeks in Manaus, Brazil. The congregation where we attended had long had an involvement with that church in Manaus. A few years earlier, an American team of missionaries had been working there, but had since left the work mostly in the hands of local Christians. This mission trip had several goals, including providing medical care in the name of Christ to a needy population, partnering with and encouraging local Christians, and helping make the community more aware of the church in Manaus. This was a large team effort with many American Christian doctors, dentists, and support personnel. The mission team that had formerly served in Manaus as long-term missionaries now served as interpreters, facilitators, and cultural liaisons. Everyone worked side by side with Brazilian Christians. We were able to provide medical care to roughly 1,000 people each day the clinic was open. Our children, Joanna and Daniel, were seven and five at the time and connected extremely well with the Brazilian children, despite the language differences. It was a crazy, exciting, and sometimes heart-rending experience. As our time in Manaus was beginning to wind down, the former missionaries began to have some interesting and startling conversations with Linda and me. They said things like, "We really could have used a couple like you on our team," and asked, "Have you ever considered going into long-term mission work?" The answer at the time was all too obvious to us. "Of course not. I'm not a preacher. Missionaries are preachers. I've gotten, believe it or not, much better at public speaking than I was then, so you can imagine how incapable I felt of being a preacher." They suggested that I didn't need to be a preacher to be a missionary, and God began turning our hearts towards missions. Over the next several years, we participated in short-term medical, construction, and World Bible School-focused missions to Mexico, Guyana, Zimbabwe, and Tanzania. One of these involved 7 weeks away from the fire department job through a series of carefully orchestrated vacation days, shift trades, and such. God continued to work on our hearts, and we spent a lot of time in prayer trying to figure out our place in all of this. Was God preparing us for a longer-term mission effort, as the Manaus missionaries had hinted? Then one day, we got a call from Dr. Maurice Hood. He was a shepherd at a congregation where we had attended while we were in college. He was one of the first heart surgeons in Austin and was a very good friend. He was dedicated to medical missions and had made many trips to the Nigerian Christian Hospital to do surgery there, general surgery. He let us know that there was a Christian clinic in Ghana that needed some help and asked if we would consider moving there. It was kind of, again, kind of take us back a little bit. We said that we'd prayerfully consider it. Within a year's time, we'd made a survey visit, decided that God was calling us to this work, quit my great fire department job, leased out our house, and moved to Yindi, Ghana in West Africa with our 10-year-old son and 12-year-old daughter, with the expectation of living there for the next 5 years. Our job in Yindi as medical missionaries was obviously to help treat the sick in the name of Christ and share his compassion and good news. Another big focus was to work ourselves out of a job. The Christian clinic and the Yindi Church of Christ had been there long before we came, though they had gone through a lot of struggles and were having a pretty tough time. We felt one big reason we were there was to nurture, encourage, and equip the local Christians so that they could better function as a Christian clinic and as a church without the presence of outside missionaries. God bless those efforts, and the church and clinic continue today without foreign resident missionaries since our departure at the end of 2004. During those 5 years, we learned a great many things. In particular, we learned that traditional animistic cultures perceive the physical and the spiritual to be much more tightly linked than the typical Western viewpoint. Honestly, I believe the separation of spiritual and physical is greatly exaggerated in our Western thinking. This has several implications. Praying with patients in a Christian clinic is vitally important. We gave the best medical care we could give, but we also prayed with and for each and every one of our patients. Somewhat surprisingly, even devout Muslim men in Yindi appreciated it when the American lady nurse prayed with them as part of the treatment. We also discovered a common but serious related problem faced by many new Christians in traditional village settings. In these settings, many turn to Christ and find the spiritual healing that they need, but they're left unclear and a bit baffled when they're faced with health issues with themselves and their families. In Ghana, this often resulted in new Christians returning to the juju man, or what a lot of us would call witch doctor, when someone was sick. This often leads them back to their formal spiritual habits, worshiping of idols and all that sort of thing. While we were there, we created a handbook and taught basic classes to many of the village church leaders and two of the Bible colleges in the southern part of the country. The goal of these classes and the handbook was to equip at least a few of the Christian leaders in most villages to be able to provide the most basic health care. We're not trying to make doctors out of anyone, just kind of give them really the basic knowledge most of us come out of middle school with, so that they can help their Christian neighbors and neighbors that aren't Christians to be more healthy. And so they'd have enough information to make a good decision about when it might be necessary to seek outside medical attention and make the sometimes arduous trek that would take them out of their village to somewhere they could get better care. A big part of the research work that Linda and I are doing now is to upgrade the information for the book we created for Ghana and to add to it to make it internationally appropriate. We hope to develop materials that can be used by healthcare professionals to equip village Christian leaders and to provide this very basic level of health assistance to people in their village so they're not turning back to their old spiritual habits. And it's been an amazing journey so far, and it's just been quite something to see the way God continues to work through these things. That's the basic highlights of the story. At this point, we're going to see what Rob has to throw at me.
Well, that's okay. I'll just talk loud. I think this is a pretty obvious question, but I thought I'd put a twist on it at first and ask how being a firefighter has helped prepare you for being a shepherd. Something about putting out fires and things like that.
There's a pretty good passage in Jude about saving people from the fire.
Saving people from the fire. There you go. That's good. With all your mission work, even in Africa and Cambodia and other places, and Brazil as well, how has that influenced your work as a shepherd at a place like Leander? Obviously, the context is incredibly different, but in what ways do you see your work as a missionary informing the work that you do here as a shepherd?
There's a lot of things I could say about that. One thing that immediately comes to mind, this may be a little bit controversial, but I'll just throw it out there. We talked about the spiritual and the physical, and it seems to me that the spiritual world is in some ways a lot more transparent in places where it's more acknowledged. And in a lot of ways, I think that our time in the mission field, I'll go ahead and throw in the football analogy since this is the day. We got to, have, front row 50-yard line seats watching God at work in a lot of really amazing ways. Now, that's true. You can see God at work wherever you are. But the kind of things and the kind of, really obvious, some of it kind of spooky obvious, spiritual warfare that we were able to see and see God, God being God. God having the power, and God, sometimes to our dismay, God plays the long game, if you will. But seeing God work through situations over, there are some rather ugly situations that started early in our time that we had our doubts, our human frailty doubts. What is God doing here? When is He going to step in and deal with some of these issues that, by the time we did see that, we saw the refining by fire. We saw people that were, like the Simon the Sorcerer type situations that were there, that were trying to get, the goodies, if you will, that they could get through various mission efforts that were around that weren't really dedicated to God. And through some very complex trials, we saw that refining, and we saw the true Christian warriors be raised up by God and come through, and the others, being skimmed off with the bad stuff that gets refined off with those purified gold refining by fire type illustrations.
Linda was telling me that one part that you didn't share was about World Bible School and the way that that has influenced your faith in pretty immense ways. Would you mind sharing some of that with us?
Sure. Well, yeah, the we spent, I was for 13, 14 years or so, I was a deacon in charge of the mailing out of the Little Action newspaper. And in the early days of that, Rule Lemons and Tex Williams were, you know, in there getting their hands dirty, rolling the papers up. And we got a tremendous amount of mentoring and hearing the stories of some of the places they'd been and the mission work they had done. Got a lot of really good contact, just working elbow to elbow, doing physical labor with people I would call giants in the faith and giants in the mission field as well.
As part of this vision process, we've been looking at some stats about Williamson County, and one that we noticed that the vision team noticed that was a little bit startling was that in Williamson County, over 60% of the people consider themselves to not have any religious affiliation. And so we all understand that we live in challenging times in many ways. Of course, challenges can bring about some great opportunities for us as well. But as a shepherd, working within a congregation, that's, you know, certainly part of understanding our community is to look at stats like that. What do you think is most important as a shepherd in a challenging time like this? And then for a congregation as well, what are some of the things that we just need to be sticking with, so to speak?
That's a pretty broad question, but I'd say you talked a good bit about it this morning with the lesson. A lot of it is just recognizing the magnitude of what God has given us and how astoundingly rich that gift is, and realizing the need to let that light shine and to share that gift with others that, 60% you say that have no connection, that most of them don't realize, you know, what's out there that they could have. We need to, I'm not always the best at it either, but we need to let that joy show. We need to live lives that make people want to know what it is that makes us live like that. I want some of that too, you know. It's the best I can do for now.
That's good. It was a broad question. This one perhaps would be a little bit more focused. What is your favorite part of being a shepherd?
Well, I think a lot of it is, I guess, feeling like that I guess like being a fireman, feeling like you can be there and do the things that need to be done. I've always been a kind of a get or done guy, but being able to be in the middle of things and being able to help make things hopefully come out with a better outcome than they might have if I'd been somewhere sitting on my thumbs.
How about the most challenging, frustrating, disappointing aspects of being a shepherd?
Well, I really like to try and keep things on a positive note.
I know, but I'm not going to let you totally.
But I guess I would have to say this wobbly podium. No, wobbly podium. No, I guess I'd have to say seeing people that are struggling, facing the same problems again and again, that you're trying to reach out to and trying to help them see the solutions to, that just seem to be continually struggling. It's just hard to see people in that kind of pain and kind of have a pretty good idea of what it would take, but not being able to get them to internalize these things. And, you know, that's not pleasant, but it's out there.
One last question. So there was a book that came out not too long ago. It's called, I think it was called Aha. It talks about these aha moments in our life, times that we get a really clear picture of God, or a time that causes us to reflect and think about our faith, think about God perhaps in a deeper way than we have before. Can you think of any aha aha moments in your life that you could share with us?
Well, I shared a couple of them in this little talk. I mean, when those long-term missionaries in Manaus started talking to us about being missionaries, we were thinking, no, that's not us. And we kind of, it was not an instant aha moment, but it was kind of a gradually blossoming aha moment. But there have been, there's been a lot of times when you kind of, well, and the other thing I talked to on one of the earlier questions, when we were in Ghana, struggling with just some really, really long-term heartrending, we're talking about, learned a lot about prayer. The Ghanaian Christians know how to pray, I'll tell you. But there were some things the church was going through there, that we had prayer nights that would start about this time and go till 2 a.m. that people would just be pouring their hearts out to God, looking for some answer, some relief, really, in a lot of that situation. And some of those situations that they were struggling with went on for 2 or 3 years. And then, and the people, and, you know, we trusted God. We said, why are you letting us suffer this long? I mean, you see that in a lot of the prophets as well. But then when we started seeing some of the answers that God provided, it was an aha moment. It was, okay, well, that makes sense. You know, this wouldn't have come to this good of an answer if God had just stepped in, I don't think, at the time that we were thinking from our terms, why doesn't he step in now? And so that was, I would say, is a biggie. Okay.
Yeah, good deal.
Thanks for your attention.